Well, good morning or good afternoon to everybody that's on the line, depending upon where you're calling in from. My name is Barb Pello, and I'd like to welcome you to a live publication webinar, Education in the E-Book, What Do Readers Tell Us? And it's sponsored by Canon Solutions America. I'm a group director at InfoTrends, and I'll be your moderator today. Before we get started, I do want to take just a second to point out the Tips for Attendee widget on your console. It's the blue one with the wrench on it. If you missed the tech tips video we played leading up to the webinar, you can always click on this widget for more information. Half of American adults today own an e-reading device. We're going to spend some time discussing this today. A few years ago, President Obama targeted getting e-textbooks into every classroom by 2017. Some states actually passed legislation requiring e-book adoption for public schools. But there's still a lot of controversy relative to the educational impact on students and the overall learning process. Today, I am really delighted to be joined by Naomi Barron. She's the professor of linguistics and executive director at American University Center for Teaching, Research, and Learning. With her new book entitled Words on Screen, The Fate of Reading in the Digital World, she's going to bring us today fact-based data to the case for print. She and her colleagues surveyed over 400 university students in the U.S., Japan, Germany, Slovakia, and India. What she found was a surprising preference for print, especially when students wanted to concentrate. And so what she's going to do is really share those insightful research findings. She's going to talk to you about the e-book market, considerations for publishers, distributors, and educators, spend some time reviewing her research, and we'll wrap up with some recommendations and conclusions. Before I turn it over to Naomi, what I did want to do was share with you some research on emerging trends in the book market. I'll then turn over to Naomi, and then we'll wrap it up with some Q&A. Now, just about, 5 or 6 months ago, we did some research in conjunction with North American Publishing Company. And what we did is we did a study on emerging trends, digital media adoption in book publishing. And what we looked at was critical trends around the market. One of the questions that we asked you and your peers was what percentage of your company's annual revenue come from the following areas. And what you're seeing is that print still remains a major source of revenue. Now, the next thing that we asked was how do you typically produce a new book title for publication? And what do you think is going to happen in the future? And clearly, what we're seeing in this study is that digital on-demand printing is going to increase at the expense of traditional offset type technology. One of the other things that we asked you and your peers was which option best describes your company's approach to producing a new book title for publication. And what you're seeing is that typically what you're doing is you're making that decision on a per publication basis. In a lot of instances, both formats are produced for every new title. And in some instances, print is the only choice. Now, we also asked, when do you expect your company to offer ebook versions of publications? And what you're seeing is that both you and your peers are planning on offering, if you haven't already, ebook versions of most typical publications. We also asked companies what your policy was for making backlist titles available digitally. And what we're seeing is, obviously, people are very motivated to make backlist titles available digitally, and that was in 30% of the instances. Sometimes backlist titles are made available digitally for specific segments or for specific authors. And in other instances, backlist titles are made available digitally based on print sales. The real question that you want to take a look at, and what we're going to explore today in the webinar, is print versus digital, which is better. And there's a lot of controversy around that. But clearly, when you think about print and you look at the data surrounding ebooks, print can be better for giving that hands-on experience. It can be learning, a part of that learning to love to read at an early age, and it's a great conduit for focusing attention. In some instances, digital can be more interactive, it can be more rewarding, and it may cater to a child's unique learning style. The key message is that both formats will help advance early reading skills. What we're going to do now, though, is we're going to listen and ask an expert relative to what she found in terms of setting the preferences of university students. And with that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn it over to Naomi. Naomi, take it away. And before you start, one quick comment. Please feel free to ask questions throughout the session. We'll be monitoring the Q&A tab and ask questions as they come in. So with that, Naomi, take it away.
Thanks so much, Barb, and welcome everyone. I want to start in what may seem a very unconventional way, namely by asking you to consider the platform shoe, and I took the most outlandish picture I could come up with for one of them. And next, I want you to consider margarine. Yes, oleomargarine. Why am I asking you to do that? Because I'd like us to think about form and function. So take the platform shoe. It may look very fashionable, but trust me, they're not very functional to wear. Or take margarine, at least when it was first developed. The idea was great. You're going to cut out all that fat from butter. But it proved to be highly problematic when we discovered there was this thing called trans fat that was incredibly unhealthy for us, and the fat from natural butter was actually much better. In thinking about form and function, I think about the work of the architect, the Chicago architect, Louis Sullivan. We have him to thank for skyscrapers. We also have him to thank for this notion of form following function. That is, figure out what you want to do with something and then decide what the design should be. That concept from him really became the leading mantra of what became the Bauhaus movement. Let's focus on notions of form and function when it comes to written work. So there's some kinds of publications. Think of an art book. You really care about what kind of paper you are using for that book. Now compare newspapers. Well, there's a reason we talk about newsprint, because you don't really intend to save it. Or you take things that are online. You know, Huffington Post comes to mind, but name your favorite blog, where there's no real intention to preserve what you're reading. It's just to look at it, do it on the run, and online works very well for a number of those kinds of stories. Let's turn our attention now to what it means to create something new as a product or as a concept. If you're coming up with some new product or concept, you've got to figure out how do you get the general public that you'd like to adopt it and maybe buy it to accept it and to want it. So there are a couple of possible ways in which this could happen. Either there's an existing need that has been filled one way and now you fill it another. So we have had boats and we had trains after a while, and now we have airplanes. But we also may decide, I want to create a need for people. Take something like the remote control for a television. Television did not used to come with remote control. Some of you may be old enough to remember this. The remote control tremendously changed our notion of what it meant to watch a television program. And we changed our expectation structures because somebody decided we could make a lot of money by giving the consumer a particular kind of control. Or take something like Siri, or I don't care what your favorite version of Siri is, in this case on Apple products. We didn't think we needed Siri. Apple thought we needed Siri, and we'll decide in the future whether or not that turns out to be true. Let's think now about why people are motivated to create new things. And yes, I am getting to books. So we might have a social motivation that says it's important for society that we come up with a new solution for something. So think of a cure for cancer, or think about an educational mission where we say we want to give access to education to people who don't have it, and maybe by, in this particular case, having a digital form of a book rather than a print form of the book, there may be millions of people who can get access to written text who wouldn't have been able to otherwise. Then there's the monetary profit. There's a monetary motivation. So my example here is Amazon's drone project, and we can have our own views of whether this is a safe thing to happen or not, but it is to speed up delivery, which is to increase the bottom line of Amazon. And then obviously there are times when somebody can commercially profit by something that is also socially useful, so drug companies can make money from cancer drugs that cure people's cancers. And then the same thing can be said in principle about digital books. If they are well done, they do save students money much of the time, not all the time, and at the same time can generate revenues for the publishers. Today what I'd like to do is give you a really quick overview on the rise of ebooks and the trajectory of ebooks since the introduction of the Kindle. I then want to focus on two other issues. The first is the motivation issues. Who wants us to want ebooks? What are those rationales? And then the second major focus is going to be on readers. What do we know about what readers themselves will tell us if we bother to ask them about their preferences in reading on print or reading on a screen and their reasons behind those preferences. And then, as Barb says, I'll have some suggestions of what we might want to do moving forward. The rise of ebooks. The first thing for us to know is long before there was anything we'd call an ebook, we were reading text on computers. So word processing started to become popular on desktop computers beginning the late 1980s, early 1990s. You then had an explosion of search tools. You know, Mosaic was the first one that was well known, and then Google came along, and the rest is history. You had newspapers realizing they needed to have online versions of their publications. Academic journals, which is the realm that I tend to spend most of my time in, began realizing they could go online as well, and some of it was a convenience issue. A lot of it, if you were a university librarian, you know it's a profit issue because the cost of academic journals is astronomical, and that's a problem that needs to be solved. But we also had, although very few people that we know used it, we had the prototype of Project Gutenberg starting way back in 1971, way before the personal computer, where you had available books that were out of copyright that had been input by hand, these days we scan, so that things could be available to a larger public without cost. In terms of e-readers, there was a history to e-readers. I won't read you what's on the slide, but there were an attempt for, a good 10-ish years or more to do things that could be portable digital devices you could read on. None of them really took off in a serious way until we get to the Kindle, which launched in late November 2007. And it had many things going for it besides its novelty, the most important of which was price. Any book you wanted was $9.99 in a digital format, which way underpriced what most of the print counterparts were. We know that Kindle's had a fair amount of competition, and whether that competition will last or not, the Nook is its own sad story. The iPad or tablets more generally have been competition. The Kobo, a Canadian-sourced e-reading device. And then if you look around the world, there are many, many locally produced devices. What we know is that once tablets came into being in 2010 in a serious way, e-readers had to catch up, and they had to start adding things like internet connectivity. So if you want to talk about the growth of e-readers, you have to say, well, is this a standalone e-reader, or is this an e-reader that's really a tablet in addition to being an e-reader? For its early years after, say, a year or two of initiation for a reading public, ebooks began to grow astronomically. Depending upon whose statistics you look at, whether you're looking at sales figures of total revenues, whether you're looking at number of copies sold, whether you're looking at adult fiction, or you're looking at all ebooks, you'll find different numbers. But if you look at between about 2009 and 10 through 2011, it's triple-digit growth in the sale of ebooks. So there was a real sense for quite some time that print is just going to be obliterated. Look at what that growth is happening with on ebooks. I will mention parenthetically, as I'm sure almost all of you know, or maybe all of you know, some of that growth comes from one bestseller, can you say 50 Shades of Grey, that suddenly make it look as if ebooks are taking off, where indeed you had a really bestseller. All right, the trajectory of ebooks has begun to shift. There was, again, depending on which numbers you want to look at, roughly a 41% growth rate. That's no longer triple digit in 2012. By 2014, it's about down to a 4% growth rate. And depending on which figures you look at, that's not so different from growth rate for print. We also have seen a fairly dramatic decline in the sale of standalone e-readers in favor of tablets, and then a decline in tablets in some instances in favor of mobile phones, particularly smartphones. I'll let you read the statistics for yourself, but basically we projected in 2011 huge numbers of e-reader sales, and by a year later, you know, as the tablet, particularly the iPad, began to take off, those numbers of projected sales reduced dramatically. You look at tablet sales, they took off very, very strongly up through 2013. By 2014, the iPad sales had fallen. Samsung was a little bit up. But the real story had to do not with any of those devices, but with what's happening with smartphones. Last year, according to Gartner, there were 1.2 billion smartphones sold worldwide. The new figures for 2015 suggest they are declining somewhat. In part, that has to do with the Chinese economy, but in part because there's now something of a saturation for the price point for a smartphone. Pew Research Center says that as of last year, about two-thirds of American adults own smartphones. That number is probably up a little bit now into 2015. So it's the smartphone we really need to be thinking about, and we're thinking about reading on a screen rather than reading on a computer screen or a tablet or an e-reader. Okay, in some of the world, reading on a mobile phone, if it's the only device you have available for accessing print, is precious. So in thinking about attitudes towards reading on screens versus reading in hard copy, we have to think about which country and which purpose. Again, it's the form follows function. If you only have one kind of device available, and it may not be ideal, but it's sure better than nothing, we have to ask, is that a device we should encourage? And for countries that absolutely cannot afford an awful lot of print or an awful lot of computers, but do have mobile phones, it becomes a viable reading device. World Reader is a leader in this initiative. It used to have hard copy books, and it's moving now increasingly to mobile phones and books available there. One of the things we need to think about, though, is what the relationship is between the real estate, the screen size on which you're reading, and what it means to read. With the coming of the Apple Watch, there are a number of applications that are now out there to be able to read Moby Dick on your watch. And we'll talk about whether that's useful or not. Let's come now and focus on the motivation question, or what I call, who wants you to want ebooks? So there are some genuine needs, and there are some generated needs. So an example of a generated need, if you're in California, boy, we will understand this. Should we have desalinization plants so there will be water to drink and water with which to water water crops? That's a genuine need. They're generated needs. One of my favorite, it's old, but it's still a favorite, is the Pet Rock, which came in its own little carrying case. Would you believe that people bought these things and spent good money? They really did. But it's not a genuine need in the sense of something like desalinization. So in talking about the motivation, who wants us to want ebooks or digital reading, we can look at publishers and distributors. We can look at people in education, both K through 12 and then some of the federal initiatives, as well as what I'll focus on, namely colleges and universities. Okay, publishers and distributors. Many of you in the audience are the experts here more than I. I'm a university person, and I'll tell you just from my perspective how I look at these issues. We know that Amazon started as a distributor. It became a publisher, and there are issues of monopoly. I'm not going to go into any of the legal ramifications there. Rather, I'll turn to the Book Industry Study Group, which has adopted a very strong digital focus since its early founding back in 1975. My own experience with Book Industry Study Group, for which I'm extremely grateful for their incredibly useful studies, was when I was at an International Digital Publishing Forum meeting in New York, and I heard about one of their sessions called Making Information Pay for Higher Education. Now, I am both a lawyer I am both an author and an educator, so I care about making books available. I also would like people to buy my books and what the heck make some money off of them. But my first concern is, are we as a publishing industry and as an educational enterprise having fair prices for the books so that students will acquire them, so that they will read them? My issue is I want people to learn if they do not have the books because of price point, they will not acquire them. So the question then becomes, to what extent is the move towards digital publishing and education profit-driven as opposed to educationally driven? And I'm afraid it's some of both. I came across on one of the listservs that I get from Digital Book World almost a year ago, this from Thad McElroy, who's an educational publishing consultant. He said in December 14, discrediting print textbooks as the primary vehicle for pedagogy has been the most important trend in the higher education publishing market. And I thought, I hope that's not true. digital pedagogy can be incredibly useful, but as I will argue, not even our students always agree that is the case for all learning. So let's look at what happened in the education world in terms of digital books. It really started in the K-12 world, and it really started entirely for economic reasons in the state of California. This is before the Great Recession. There was the California recession when then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said, We don't have the budget in California to buy textbooks for our students. This was high school at that point he was talking about. We're going to have to create digital books and have those available, in essence, for free because we can't pay for the traditional kinds of books. Similarly, there have been a lot of other initiatives that are heavily finance-driven rather than education-driven. So if we drop down to the bottom of this slide on the initiative by Dick Durbin and Al Franken, the Affordable College Textbook Act, I don't know if that's going to go anywhere, but the goal is to create some basically open educational resources digitally that can be available to anyone that will not have the costs of it, that have been attached to college textbooks, which have been a killer for students really trying to learn, acquire books, and not know how to pay both tuition and textbook costs. Moving to universities, there have been a number of initiatives. Probably the best known started at Indiana University, maybe 5-6 years ago, where the chief information officer said, you know what, I negotiate all the time with software companies to get lower prices where I need to get university-wide site licenses. What if I negotiate with publishers on their e-books? So one of the things we know is that there is a price attached to an e-book that is far higher than the cost of distributing the e-book, which is much lower. Now, there are many costs that go into producing books. Believe me, I understand this. But he was able to negotiate with first a small number of publishers and then a much larger set to say, I'm going to make you a deal that you can't refuse. Instead of paying $49.95 or whatever it is for the digital version of this chemistry textbook, we're going to pay you, and I don't know the exact figure, $15 for each student. But the clincher is going to be every student is going to pay that. We're going to build it in as a fee, and there's not going to be the used book market issue. There's not going to be the issue of our five students going in together and buying one book. Are they not acquiring the book at all? They register for the course. They're going to pay the fee, and at first the university paid it, and I'm assuming by now that the students are probably paying it themselves. But it was a model that then became a much larger initiative through both EDUCAUSE and the organization Internet 2 that many colleges and universities belong to, saying we might try this out. And it's been a really interesting initiative. My major concern has been the overwhelming motivation behind it has been monetary rather than educational. Most of the books we're talking about are either PDF versions or EPUB 3 versions that are not terribly sophisticated. We're not talking about digitally native books, which can be educationally extremely useful. But it's been cost that has been driving the agenda rather than education. There's a very nice initiative coming out of Rice University called OpenStax College that is one of the most important spearheading pieces of the Open Educational Resources Initiative, which is sprouting up in many ways all over the country. And it's something that, as publishers and distributors, you need to be thinking about because many universities, the state of Virginia community college system is now going only with open educational resources. The University of Maryland University College is now moving only to open educational resources. And they're not doing it because they dislike the content of textbooks, whether they are digital text versions or whether they're print versions. They're going to save money. And we have to figure out collectively how we're going to work together and make this happen. So I'm sure you know as well about some of the bookstore initiatives. Bookstores are going broke because people are not buying the books that are brought in. Renting is becoming far more popular, whether it's hard copy or digital. As an educator, I have problems with people renting a book they don't want to write in if it's the hard copy because they don't learn as much if they can't make themselves any notes. No, they do not any longer have a separate notebook where they make themselves notes. Bookstores are starting to disappear. We know about the Amazon initiative at Purdue, and I'm sure that is spreading. Other kinds of trends. We know that online courses in general are rising in number, and as a result of that, so is digital reading. And it makes a certain amount of sense. If you're not going to see your students face-to-face, it's sort of hard to say, well, go buy the print version of the book. Well, if we think online is good for learning as a course, it should be good for reading as well. We have many, many well-meaning faculty who say, I want to save the students money. I haven't thought about whether it's going to be better to learn in one venue or another. We also have green teaching initiatives, including at my own university, where we're looking at how we can help be environmentally smart by, among other things, not printing a syllabus for a course or not encouraging students to print out articles that are very technical. And I'm not sure that's the best for learning, and maybe it saves some paper. All right. Let me talk about the research that I myself have done. I was very curious to know not what were the economic motivations for doing digital reading, and I'm thinking largely for school purposes, and I focus on the university, but also I asked a lot of questions having to do with pleasure reading. It occurred to me from my anecdotal conversations with students that they weren't always doing what the university administration felt the students would want, because the students use so many digital devices and are on their cell phones so much and they run out of battery before the day is over. Administrators tend to assume that, of course, they'll want to do everything digitally, so we should go to where they are. And I thought, well, what if we ask the students themselves, which is what I did. So I'll review with you my research and then mention some of the other research that's happening in a few other places. I want to talk briefly about some of the effects that e-books are having, or digital reading more generally, on readers, and then equally important, the effects having on that e-reading is having on writers, because we have a kind of spiral starting up of if we assume students want to read a particular way or readers in general want to read a particular way, we change the way we write, and I'll give you some examples of that in a minute. Barb described a little bit of what my study was about. It was a cross-national study with 5 different countries administered in 2013 and 14, and then for India, some of the people actually responded in early 2015. It's not a huge sample, but I don't think we need a huge sample of students who all seem to be telling us the same thing whenever you ask. And anecdotally in the literature, as I'm sure you've seen, you hear exactly the same kinds of messages. What I'm concerned about is not to be judgmental and say one kind of reading is better than another, but I'm interested in whether the nature of reading itself is changing. because the digital medium has a particular set of what are called affordances, of things they're particularly good at doing, and reading slowly and contemplatively is not among them. Skimming and scanning and searching and jumping from screen to screen is what they tend to be good at, which is not what traditional reading, at least in part, has been all about. So I'd like to talk about four particular kinds of findings that I had from my research. I want to talk about the cost issue, length of text, multitasking, and then the concentration or distraction issue, two sides of a coin. First, on the cost issue. There have been a number of national studies done in the United States, one, for example, by Student Monitor back in 2013, when they happened to ask, what do you like most about reading a digital text, an e-text? And the answer was really clear, was cost. It costs less money than buying the print version. I will note, as many people have as well, that if you get used books, they're less expensive than digital, but that's another story. In my own data, I had a survey that some students took online, some students took in hard copy. If you're in a traditional country, you had to do it in hard copy. But the survey asked, among other things, if the cost were the same, would you prefer, for schoolwork or for reading for pleasure, would you prefer to have it in hard copy, in print, or would you prefer to read it digitally? And the answers were pretty clear. For all five of the countries, summed together, 87% said for schoolwork, I would prefer print. And I've given the data for the United States and Germany, which had the highest percent of students saying, I really want print. So it's 89% for the U.S. and 94% for Germany. What about reading for pleasure? I thought, well, maybe that's going to be different. Not quite as high, but close. 81% overall said, if I'm reading for pleasure, I would prefer to read in hard copy. These are 18 to 24-year-olds. In the case of Germany, they tended to be a little older, so I took 26-year-olds. But these are the digital millennials. This is not people who are 75 years old. These are a current generation of university students telling us, this is what I prefer, thank you. On the length issue, the results I got were the results I expected, namely if it's a long text, whether you're reading for schoolwork or you're reading for pleasure, I'd prefer to read it in hard copy. So higher statistics for the United States and Germany, but still overall a preference for reading in hard copy. If something is short, there was equal preference, and it bounced around from country to country as to whether, either for schoolwork or for pleasure, they would rather read in hard copy or print. That is, there was no clear pattern. Multitasking, that is the main problem with reading on a computer screen, because you can have multiple screens open at the same time. So I asked the question, how often do you tend to multitask when you are reading in hard copy, when you're reading on a screen? And I've summed together here not often at all, occasionally, sometimes and very often. So I summed together the sometimes and very often. And overall, across all four countries, it's not that much difference. 41% said I tend to multitask when I'm reading hard copy, 66% on screen. But if you look at the figures for the United States and Germany, you'll see a major distinction, namely 25% of the United States said I tend to multitask when I'm reading in hard copy, 85% on screen. Germany, similar numbers. And some of this issue has to do with where they're doing their reading when they're reading digitally. I did ask, indeed, where are you doing your reading? And in Japan, for example, they're doing most of their digital reading on their phones, where it is much harder to be multitasking. Another contaminating factor, as my students remind me, is I can be sitting and reading a print book and have my cell phone next to me and multitask. So it's hard to ask this as a straight question, but it's pretty clear the students know they're much more likely to multitask when they are reading something on a screen than when they're reading in hard copy. And this shows up.
Naomi,
yeah, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a real quick question, Naomi. And that is, actually, I've got two of them.
Okay.
You know, I have grandchildren, and they don't know a world without four screens, right? Do you see any changes as you look at that younger population in terms of preferences for print versus digital, given the world that they've grown up with, or any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm very glad you asked about younger kids because they are even harder to make sense of than, let's say, university-aged students. And the reason they're harder to make sense of is it's largely the parents who are making the decisions for the kids as to what they want their kids exposed to. So if you present screens, whether you present a really fun-looking tablet or you say, let's read together on an e-reader, or you have a game that does the equivalent of what a tablet or an e-reader does, and you say, this is fun, this is what we should do, young kids will listen to us. So a lot of the habits they are picking up are not their preferences. It is parental preference. The really interesting thing, though, is when you ask parents for a child, let's say preschool, would you prefer that child encounter a book as an e-book or encounter it as a print book? Statistically, they will tell you print. And there's some really good reasons why. There have been some nice studies done that essentially show that if you give a child a book to read electronically, a young child, so let's talk about pre-KK kind of age or even, you know, nursery school a little before then, much of the attention is spent on the device itself, not on the content of the book. So there are some tests that have been done. There's been some studies done that essentially show the kids are not attending nearly as much to the content of the reading when they are reading on a digital device, because the digital device itself is too interesting. As you get to a little bit older, you get people into lower school, even into middle school, there's again this question of what are the educators, what are the parents telling students they should want? So if you say, and we're going to have e-books, and everybody has an iPad, and this is how we're going to do our reading, and then you go in and you ask the students, so what do you think? Well, the authority figures just told you what you're supposed to like. And my concern is not whether people like digital devices. I love digital devices. But how we change our pedagogy as a result of using these digital devices. Because one of the things, and we can talk about, we'll talk about this a little bit later, is we tend to give shorter things to read. We tend to give things that are less complex to read when you're reading them in digital devices. We tend to require less reading overall. So we're changing the nature of what we're asking people to read, what we're asking them to learn, what we're asking them to think knowledge is about. And they'll believe us because they tend to trust us. That's what worries me.
Okay, gotcha.
So let's look at what the college-age students say, and I'll bet you'll find the same thing if you look at younger kids, as to where they find it easiest to concentrate. I asked them, you know, take all the possible digital devices plus hard copy. Where is it easiest to concentrate? Simple question. 92% overall said it's easiest to concentrate in hard copy. Well, excuse me, if we're in educational institutions, I don't care at what level, K through 12 or university, and the students are telling us they concentrate best when they're reading in hard copy, shouldn't we be listening to this? Now, it is definitely the case that there is going to be a growing amount of reading that's done digitally, but as I'll say in my wrap-up, we have to learn how to train. We have to learn ourselves, and then we have to train students how to concentrate in reading digital formats, because digital formats are so much of the time not that which we really focus attention on in a serious way. Okay, a few more pieces of data on distractibility. This comes from the U.S. National Survey of Student Engagement. They survey freshmen, they survey seniors, and they ask, how often do you get distracted when you're doing your coursework by social media, which is going to mean digitally? And a fifth of the students in their first year said, that's me. A third of the seniors. All right, so this is only going to grow with time. All right, another set of questions I asked, and I'll go through these fairly quickly. You'll have the slides available afterwards. You can go look at them more. Is what is the one thing you like most about reading in print? What is the thing you like, the one thing you like least about reading in print? The one thing you like most about digital reading, the one thing you like least? I gathered all this stuff and we translated it out of different languages and we just are finishing coding it. Okay, I'll give you the data for the U.S. because we're in the U.S. now. 74% of what people liked most, remember, these are 18 to 24-year-olds, These are people who have grown up with digital devices. 74% said they like some physical attribute of a book. That's what they like most about print. It's easier to annotate, and they know how to annotate digitally, but it's much easier to annotate with your hand and a pen. Okay, physically turning pages, and there are hundreds and hundreds of other responses. Cognitively, it's easier to remember. It's easier to concentrate. They just spontaneously said this. They could have said anything. And then the number of people talked about aesthetics. They said, it's relaxing. I enjoy it. Okay, what is it they like least about print? Access, convenience. And we understand this. You'll see the flip side of this when we look at what they like most about reading digitally. So 60%, again, this is the U.S. subjects, they like something that's handy, it's easy to carry, it's lightweight. What do they, you know, they don't like paper cuts. Interestingly, they say things like the articles seem longer if it's in print than if it's digitally. Well, why is that? Because we know they spend less time reading when they read the same number of words digitally, if you're not monitoring them, than they'd spend on the same information when they read in print. We need some education, or we need to change back to print. And then a lot of students are concerned about wasting paper and resources, a point I'll come back to in a second, and they absolutely talk about cost. What do they like most about digital? Flip side, access, convenience. There are some physical attributes to digital screens. They can scroll quickly. Well, that means they don't read, but sometimes scrolling is appropriate. Can read it in the dark. If you were to ask people who are 50, 60, 70 years old the same question about what you like most about digital, you'll hear an awful lot of you can change the font size, and obviously that's important. And then a number of students, again, this is the U.S. students, what do they like most about reading digital? 15% said, saves the environment. It saves printing money, because we know that print cartridges are expensive. What do they like least? More than half of them complained about some physical attribute of the digital screens. Namely, it hurts their eyes. It's astounding, and this was true across all of the countries I studied. People said, my head hurts after a while, or I can't highlight or make notes. Well, you could, but it's more complicated to do. If it's a PDF, it's harder. But what do they like least? 43% in the U.S. complained about something cognitive. It's distracting. It's hard to concentrate. They understand. It's we, the educators, saying, oh, just read everything digitally. It'll all be fine, who haven't thought to ask, is this really working for students? And then emotional aesthetic. I don't get the same feeling as I do when I'm reading a hard copy book. Again, these are not 50-year-olds. This was from a 20-year-old. All right, some other comments. I like hard copy. I think hard copy is much better, but I use digital for school to save paper. I usually don't care enough about those readings to want to keep them. This broke my heart when I read it. I gave the students a chance to just give any other comments they wanted. This was one of them. For me, reading a book for pleasure will always be associated with holding the actual book in your hands and truly experiencing it. Interestingly, there's anecdotal evidence from around the world of 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds saying things such as, I read this book in the Harry Potter series digitally, and I liked it so much I saved my allowance so I could buy the hard copy, and then I could read it and put it on my shelf, and that's part of who I am. So younger readers, to go back to Barb's issues, they feel the difference between print and hard copy. I have limited space, and I can't store a lot of hard books. It is not ideal, but I try to be practical. So at some point, parents and educators, by which I mean teachers of varying sort, need to figure out how do we train people as to what counts as practical. It's not that I have the simple answer, but I do have the questions. The next slide, I won't read to you. I'll just say it's a nice compilation that was put together by Doxity on pros and cons of reading platforms. Barb identified some of those in the beginning. I hear lots of them in the comments I get from students, either from my actual studies or anecdotally. I'll just mention that there are a couple of other,
Naomi, I would just a quick comment as you look at the Doxicity page. And one of the participants kind of asked, it's a statement slash question.
Okay.
He said, you know, when we take a look at the value associated with print, isn't the point that we need to develop a new paradigm based on the strength of digital capability so that they can get a more rich interactive experience that print can't deliver? And what's your comment on that one?
It's a very good question, and here's my answer. there are wonderful things that digital materials can do that print cannot. It's the same reason we brought film strips and then videos and then YouTubes and anything that is visual that moves into classrooms. If you want to see how a molecule is put together and you're teaching organic chemistry, things that are either tangible in your hand or things that move, if you want to study meiosis and mitosis in biology, to see that change is so much better done in some movable format, and a digital textbook can absolutely do that. Similarly, there's adaptive learning. And what I am able to understand the first time through may be different from what the person sitting next to me in my class is able to understand. And if you have a well-done adaptive textbook, I can tailor what I go back and review to my needs that are different from the needs of the person next to me, which can work really productively. The question that I have is this. So many disciplines are saying, we all have to go digital now. We all have to add in lots of animations. And sometimes that really is good, but it's not always so good. And the challenge for us, both as publishers and distributors on the one hand and educators on the other, is getting really thoughtful and smart about which kinds of subject matter makes most sense in which kind of venue. So intelligently done digitally native books are terrific. They're also very expensive to produce, and they have to be done well and right. There are other places where I would like to sit and have somebody, you know, if you're reading Plato's Republic, I would like you to have a hard copy. I'd like you to be able to have it on your lap and look up and stare into space, which you're not going to do if it's on your digital screen. We've got some pretty good evidence on that.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Okay. You're welcome. So there are lots of other people, not lots, there's some other people that are starting to look at the issue of how do we read in print versus read digitally. There are two projects coming out of the EU. One has basically wrapped up. It's called Cost Action, blah, 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 blah. You can see it all on your screen. And that actually involved almost a dozen countries, representatives from different countries. COST stands for Cooperation in Science and Technology. It's an initiative of the European Union. There's another action that's just starting up, run by Anne Mangan, who has done a lot of the really interesting research on comparing how we read on screens versus how we read in hard copy. I'll talk in a moment about a little bit of her work. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of research comes out of that project. Just a couple of things about the effects of ebooks on readers. And some of this is anecdotal and some is a little more statistically verifiable. You take someone like Nicholas Carr of Is Google Making Us Stupid fame, or The Shallows, the book that later expanded on that work. And both he and Marianne Wolfe, who is a reading specialist at Tufts University, will tell you they miss their old brains. That's Carr's language. But they will tell you, I find it hard to focus on print anymore. And trust me, these are two people who care a lot about reading and doing serious reading. They're finding it harder to do. I was both amused and saddened to hear an undergraduate tell me last year, this is someone who loves to read. He said, when I'm sitting and reading print, which is really what I prefer to do, I keep waiting to be interrupted. Because if he's on his computer or he's on his phone, he's going to hear a beep, he's going to see another screen, he's going to go check something else. And he is, at the tender age of 21, finding it difficult to concentrate on print, even though he wants to. So I think we have to be mindful of that. Let me go on to the next slide and talk just a little bit about the effects on writers, because I think this is a really important part of the picture. One of the things that we know is that if you want to write as an author and you'd like people to read what you write, if you want to sell what you are publishing as a publisher, you need people to find it's worth the money. What has been happening as people are increasingly using computers for reading, and now we're using smaller and smaller devices with less screen real estate, is they are adapting the things that they are publishing. So academic publishers have lots of, call them shorts, call them briefs. There are all sorts of things online. One of my favorites is an app called Snack Reads, which has, it advertises portions perfect for your lunch break, your commute, or right before bed. It's just a little bit of reading. We know there's a return of short stories and serials, and that's wonderful. I have no complaint about it. But the reason for that, rather than a hefty novel that you read in the whole, is people aren't wanting to take that whole hefty novel. Writers are noticing this. One of the things that troubles me as an author is if digital books, being particularly the self-published ones, are so cheap, I mean $1.95 or give away 100 copies for free, what does that tell readers about the value of the written word? And I worry that we are undermining our notion of what you can do with writing because of looking for lower and lower and lower pricing. Similarly, and I'll just read you what Faye Weldon had to say, you can read what a German fiction writer had to say, about how writers are concerned, about how readers' expectations of what a book is going to look like have changed. In this case, we're both talking about fiction. So what Faye Weldon, who's a very well-known British author, says is because readers are so busy, writers must focus on, quote, cutting to the chase and doing more of the reader's contemplative work for them. And that sums up one of my major concerns about digital reading as it now exists, namely that we are adapting to the technological platform rather than figuring out, because digital reading is not going to go away and it's going to increase, and I absolutely know that, we need to get smarter about the ways we read digitally and recognize for ourselves that a platform that can be really good for scanning and scrolling and searching could be good if we discipline ourselves or also reading contemplatively, but we have to figure out how to do that, and we haven't done that yet. Okay, just a couple of closing remarks, as I want to leave some time for questions. I started out with platform shoes and margarine, and I'd like to suggest that we think very seriously about what our motivations are for digital books. I mean, we could ask the same thing for print, but I'll focus on digital now and say, is the function we have in mind being filled by the form? And in many cases, not the form in its present form. Okay, I worry about what a just price for a book is. It's not that I'm looking to retire on my book royalties, but there are people who are professional writers, I mean, I have a day job, who look to being able to sell their books, who spend a lot of money doing their research. And if a book is only going to be seen as worth $2.95, regardless of how much effort went into it, we're going to change the way we write. We're going to do away with a generation of writers. Europe understands this problem with its VAT battles right now as to what you charge as value-added tax on an e-book rather than on a print book. They have to get their act together because they need to get some consistency in what's going on. And we've all already started to see what's happening with e-book subscriptions, where in a sense it's like a great big smorgasbord and you can eat as much as you want, but some of the e-book subscription companies have realized, no, they're losing money in that proposition. So we just don't have a sense right now of how that particular business model is going to go. My major concern, and this goes back to the question of what do children think, is we're going to change our expectation structures of what reading is about and the kind of pleasure that can come from reading and the kind of learning, the kind of knowledge, kind of wisdom, help us, that can come from reading. And I'll just give you two examples. It used to be you drive into a gas station, someone would pump your gas for you, and they would check your oil and they cleaned your windshield. Well, I can get out and pump my gas, and I do. I don't check my oil nearly as often as I should because no one else is doing it for me. Or even more to the chase, cutting to the chase, I would prefer when I fly from Washington to San Francisco to have them give me a meal rather than I have to bring my baggie with me or buy the food that is always not always so good on the meal. But we've changed our expectation structures of what airlines are going to supply. Similarly, we have to think about what we might be losing, throwing out the baby with the bath, by just assuming that digital is necessarily going to be the best way to go. All right. Let me just stop with this last slide and then leave a couple minutes for questions. We have assumed in some way that the market knows best, which may or may not be true. My question is, who is responsible for figuring out what we want the next generation, start at whatever age, you can start at 2 months, you can start at age 20, the next generation to learn, to care about, to enjoy, to pass on to a subsequent generation. So there's a whole series of people who have some responsibilities, and many of us, I think, have not been fulfilling those responsibilities, whether it's parents, teachers. The libraries are working really hard. I know publishers are working hard. Manufacturers are working. Readers need some guidance, particularly younger readers. Older readers, interestingly, when I give presentations, when I do radio talk shows or whatever it is, and I can tell their age, the caller calls in and says, I've been reading for 65 years. Okay, so you're probably age 70, and I don't get distracted when I'm on my e-reader or my tablet. Right, because you know how to do this. Most readers, particularly the youngest generation, don't, and we have some obligations to figure out where to go. So, Barb, shall I just cut to the end?
Sure.
Okay, let me do that. I'll advance some slides. They'll be available for you to take a look at. The main message I wanted to give you is don't assume we know what the next generation of readers wants. Ask them. You may be surprised at what you find. But now we're at question and answer session.
Yeah, so, you got it. And I do have a few questions for you that I want to make sure we cover before we wrap up. First of all, one of the questions that came back was, there's clearly a lot of different types of ebooks, and you mentioned there's, you know, flip books and there's PDF versions of ebook formats. Mm-hmm. Did you test at all, Naomi, anything about the impact of the type of ebook format predicated on the work that you did? Is there a format that might work better than what you've seen?
The answer is no, I did not. Explore that in part because I was looking across people who have very different kinds of devices in countries where, for example, there are countries where almost nobody has a tablet, almost no one has an e-reader, all the reading is done either on a smartphone or on a computer, and it was just too much mix and match. What I do know, and Amazon experimented with this a number of years ago, and it flopped, but maybe it would be more successful today. I know Japan has been launching a new initiative for a textbook size reader that says, all right, you should be able to see two pages at once. One of the things we know is if you see more text at once, your mind can refer back to what you've seen, as opposed to if you're scrolling, it's gone, out of sight, out of mind. So my guess is, if we're looking at devices, that if schools were being really smart and they said it's going to be digital, they would ask themselves, what kind, and manufacturers as well, what kind of device should we have so that you can see more text, so you're not doing so much scrolling, so the text can be stationary in front of your nose for a while. And it'd be interesting to see whether some of the new experiments in Japan with larger e-readers take off.
And did any, so the work that you did, Naomi, really didn't reflect on the impact of what I categorize as enriched content. In other words, where I had a link to video or anything like that, it was really just more of a standard structured format for e-content.
Presumably, because all I said was reading on a screen. Now, the place that connects with what you're saying, and there's been a fair amount of research on this, is if you have a text that has hyperlinks in it, And whether it links to a video or it links to another site, wherever it links somewhere other than what you're reading. And we're not talking about going to an online dictionary if you're reading a text in German. There's a lot of data. There are a lot of data clearly suggesting that to come back after you have made that foray out and then reconcentrate takes time, takes connectivity, and it's a version of multitasking. Now, if there's something that is part of the learning itself that says, now watch the video. Okay, now that you've seen the video, come and answer these questions, or here's the next puzzle that's predicated on your having learned something from that video. I am sure those are beneficial, but no, that's not what I had the opportunity to look at.
Okay. Well, I would really like to take a few minutes and thank you for what I think has been fabulous information for our audience. And you know, well, clearly there's, you know, an array of different opinions and those types of things in the marketplace. I think your message to everybody in the audience was listen to the students and the learners out there.
That is one piece of message. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Naomi.
Well, the other piece of the message is we're supposed to. I mean, as I tell my students, one of the reasons they pay me a salary to teach and you pay the tuition to come is there's something or other I should know that maybe you don't yet. So definitely we have to ask the students. That is a critical message that I'm trying to impart. But we also have to ask ourselves, what do we know? How can we be smart? And that's something we haven't done quite enough of.
Great. Well, thank you, Naomi. Now, what I would ask everybody is, first and foremost, thank you for taking time to listen to the webinar today. And in addition, if you've got a minute, please take a moment to fill out our feedback survey. And if there were some questions that came in at the last minute that we didn't get to, we've got your email addresses and we'll respond to those after the webinar. Thank you again, everybody, for your time and attention, and have a great rest of the day.